Tonight on Nova, the shocking story of a girl who spent her childhood locked in a bedroom.
The girl reportedly was still wearing diapers when a social worker discovered the case 2 weeks ago.
Raised in isolation, Jeannie was a wild child, uncivilized, barely able to walk or talk.
The indications are that she was beaten for making noise.
With footage never before seen on television, Nova follows the controversial efforts to unlock the secret of the wild child.
Once in a great while, civilized society comes across a wild child. A child who has grown up in severe isolation, with virtually no human contact. This is the story of such a case. The story begins in Los Angeles on November 4th, 1970.
Officials in the Los Angeles suburb of Arcadia have taken custody of a 13-year-old girl, and they say was kept in such isolation by her parents that she never even learned to talk. Her elderly parents have been charged with child abuse.
This is the scene of the crime. A child was locked in a room and tied to a potty chair for most of her life. Completely restrained, she was forced to sit alone day after day and often through the night. She had little to look at and no one to talk to for more than 10 years.
The girl reportedly was uttering infantile noises and still wearing diapers when a social worker discovered the case 2 weeks ago. But the authorities are hoping she still may have a normal learning capacity.
Here was a 13-year-old who seemed like an infant, a girl who would be known as Jeannie. Jeannie was taken to Children's Hospital in Los Angeles, where she immediately won the hearts of doctors and scientists.
She was fragile and beautiful, almost haunting. And so I was pulled. I was very drawn to her, even though I was nervous and had no idea, in many respects, what to expect.
Jeannie was about to test an idea important to science and society, that a nurturing environment could make up for even the most nightmarish of pasts.
If you make up a sentence in your head, or you write it down and it has, say, 10, 12 words in it, chances are you can listen for the rest of your life for someone else to say the sentence. You can go to the library.
Here at UCLA, Susan Curtis teaches students about a crucial human trait, the ability to learn language.
At the library, and chances are you will never come across that sentence. What I want to do now.
The students begin their study through a famous case.
The case name is Jeannie. This is not this person's real name, but when we think about what a genie is a creature that comes out of a bottle or whatever, but emerges into human society past childhood. And we assume that it really isn't a creature that had a human childhood.
Susan Curtis has a special connection to the story she's telling.
The story of a girl who
20 years ago, she was asked to join a team working to rehabilitate Jeannie.
I was literally at the right place at the right time. I was a new graduate student interested in language acquisition, unencumbered by family ties or responsibilities. And they asked me if I would be interested.
When Curtis first joined the case, Jeannie had a strange bunny walk and other almost inhuman characteristics. Jeannie constantly spat. She sniffed and clawed. She barely spoke or made any noises.
The indications are that she was beaten for making noise and consequently had learned basically not to vocalize. And she really didn't vocalize very much at all. When I first met her, she was silent most of the time.
Jeannie also received daily visits at Children's Hospital from James Kent, her psychologist. Kent recalls first meeting his new patient.
I was captivated by her. I was not the last person to become captivated by her. The story, as we began to learn about it, was sort of one of the things, of course, that would reach out and grab you anyway. But she had a personal quality that seemed to elicit rescue fantasies. And this in a group of people who were interested in taking care of kids and who specialized in early childhood, who were going to be sort of powered by rescue fantasies anyway. She's reached out and grabbed lots of us.
One of Jeannie's most captivating qualities was the intense way she explored her new environment. Oddly, even strangers who knew nothing about her story seemed to sense her need to do so.
One particularly striking memory of those early months was an absolutely wonderful man who was a butcher. And he never asked her name, he never asked anything about her. They just connected and communicated somehow. And every time we came in, and I know this was so with others as well, he would slide open the little window and hand her something that wasn't wrapped, a bone of some sort, some meat, fish, whatever, and he would allow her to do her thing with it. And to do her thing, what her thing was basically, was to explore it tactily, to put it up against her lips and feel it with her lips and touch it, almost as if she were blind.
Word of the wild child spread, attracting scientists from all around the country. One of them was Oklahoma psychiatrist Jay Shirley.
When introduced, I extended my hand. She reached out with her fingers and delicately touched my hand. And then, in a sense, that was it. She had made my acquaintance. She was satisfied for herself about me. But my reaction was I had 1,000 questions immediately. Who, what, how? How does this come about? Why do I see what I'm seeing?
Shirley was an expert in social isolation. Jeannie was the most extreme case he'd ever seen.
Solitary confinement is diabolically the most severe punishment, and in my experience, really quite dramatic symptoms develop in as little as 15 minutes to an hour, and certainly inside of 2 or 3 days, and try to expand this to 10 years boggles one's mind.
Shirley wanted to assess how well Jeannie had survived her long years of isolation. He directed the team to gather information on her brainwaves. For 4 nights running, they wired Jeannie to instruments that measured the electrical activity in her brain while she slept. What they found was an unusually high number of so-called sleep spindles, the dense bunching patterns that look like spindles on a spinning machine. This was an abnormal brainwave pattern. The sleep studies raised a question that would puzzle the Jeannie team for years. Was Jeannie brain damaged from her years of abuse, or had she been retarded from birth? When Jeannie was a baby, her father apparently decided she was retarded. He insisted on keeping her isolated because of that. Authorities pieced together these few facts in the early weeks. Jeannie's strange family circumstances made it hard to learn more. Jeannie's mother, weak and nearly blind, claimed that she too had been a victim of her domineering husband. Jeannie's father, shortly after authorities discovered Jeannie, shot and killed himself. The suicide only added to the interest in Jeannie's case. She was a prized patient. And in the months to come, the number of visiting scientists increased. Jeannie's new celebrity status marked the beginning of a debate that would intensify over time. How should her case be handled? James Kent's plan was the first to be adopted. He believed Jeannie could get better if she were allowed to form relationships, and he was encouraged when she started to do so.
Up until one particular day, Jeannie didn't seem to respond in any special way to my coming or going. At the end of our sessions. Then one day when I left, her expression changed from sort of happy to sad, to indicate that there was some sadness in the separation for her. And it was the first indication that I had that we were beginning to form this relationship. I thought as long as she had the capacity to form attachments, she had the capacity to learn, she had the capacity to get better.
By the end of May, something had happened to add to the hopes for Jeannie's future. It was a breakthrough that everyone had waited for.
You know what to do here.
It was captured on videotape by Jean Butler, Jeannie's special education teacher. Here, in a classroom at Children's Hospital, Butler is teaching Jeannie to tie her own shoes. Butler is about to tell Jeannie, "You do it, and we can tell Dr. Kent what you can do." Listen to Jeannie's reaction.
You do it. You do it. Then we'll tell Dr. Kent.
Huh?
Dr. Kent,
huh? Jeannie said the word doctor.
Right there it says that, doesn't it? Dr. Kent. Huh?
It was one of more than 100 words she knew by that spring. Listen to another. She was difficult to understand, but Jeannie was repeating words. Jeannie was beginning to talk.
I could tell, as all others could, just looking at her, that there was a lot to Jeannie, and that what we had to do was to make sure we gave her opportunities to express, find a way to take what was latent and express it, or somehow then, you know, acquire it, because the potential just seemed so great.
For the first time in her life, Jeannie seemed to be thriving. Her mental and physical growth since coming to Children's Hospital was obvious. Jeannie's progress gave birth to a daring hope. She might fully recover, and science might learn how. Her doctors even publicly predicted success. Their confidence was an eerie echo of a moment from the past, an echo of another case, like Jeannie's, that preceded hers by nearly 200 years. The case began in 1800, when citizens of this region in southern France discovered a remarkable creature who had crept out of the nearby forest. He was animal in behavior, human in form, mute and naked. He was a wild child. He would be known as Victor, and this statue would be erected to mark his entry into civilization. Citizens in the village where Victor was discovered guessed he was 12 years old. His food preferences, his lack of speech, and the scars on his body indicated he had been in the wild for most of his life. Victor's story intrigued historian and psychologist Harlan Lane. Around the time doctors in Los Angeles were following Jeannie's case, Lane was in France tracking Victor's story.
Shortly after the boy was captured, a biology professor took a very careful look at him, named Bonnetaire. Bonnetaire tells a story of tremendous indifference to cold that Victor had. One day he took him and took off all his clothes, and the boy was thrilled to have his clothes taken off. And he started leading him into the outdoors, and it was surrounded by snow at that time. And Victor, far from protesting, was filled with joy. He gave out cries of joy and pulled Bonnetaire out the doors and wanted to get out into the snow. On other occasions, he was actually out in the snow, bare naked, leaping about, throwing the snow in the air, eating snow. Bonnetaire concludes, and I think we have to conclude, that our sensitivity to temperature is very much influenced by our life experiences.
Word of the wild child traveled north to Paris, where the first anthropological society had just formed. It was the end of the Age of Enlightenment, a time of enormous discovery and debate.
Victor walked into the middle of a raging debate. His timing was incredible. The question was, what makes us human? What separates man from the beasts? Is it human appearance? Well, anthropological expeditions were returning with a wide variety of races, and Parisians were not so clear on human appearance. Is it walking upright? But orangutans walked upright. Is it language? First reports were that Victor had no language. Then again, perhaps he could learn some. In any case, philosophers, anatomists, and their ilk were convinced that careful study of Victor could finally answer the question, what is it that makes us human?
With Victor, Parisians had a chance to see human nature stripped of society and culture. This was a situation no one would set out to create on purpose. It was therefore referred to as the forbidden experiment. Scientists in Paris quickly summoned Victor from the south of France. Although Victor could hear, they brought him to this school, the National Institute for the Deaf.
Okay, we're at the National Institute for the Deaf, and it happened right here. The gardener from Rodez brings the wild boy right through here, into the courtyard, and I guess they were expected, and the director, the Abbé Sicard, comes out, and come on, they would meet about here. Sicard comes out, and what does he see? Not a nice little bourgeois deaf kid in the school uniform, his new pupil, but a raging, spitting, snarling, filthy savage. Defecating where he is, urinating where he is, biting, covered with scars, long hair, wadded, yellow teeth, long fingernails. A savage. Sicard never seen anything like that in his life. So he backs off. What's he gonna do? Idea. He's just hired a young physician from the military hospital up the street, followed by the name of Jean-Marc Itard. So he calls, Itard! Itard!
Jean-Marc Itard was a 26-year-old medical student who was ready to make his mark. He saw the wild boy as an opportunity.
Well, Itard was an interesting man, wasn't he? How is he going to make a name for himself, a place for himself, in medicine and in the intellectual excitement of the time? Because he was a brilliant fellow, and he read philosophy astutely, he studied medicine. Well, the answer was that here was a chance that would make or break him. If he could actually civilize a wild child, the first person in history to do so, why, he would be a figure down through history. Even in the 20th century, people might be discussing him.
Itard's ambitions would pay off. Not only would people in the 20th century still be discussing him, but the famous French director François Truffaut would play Itard in a movie about the case. The movie illustrates the risk Itard took. More experienced doctors concluded Victor was profoundly retarded from birth and unable to learn. Itard, though, believed that Victor had become retarded because of his years of living in the wild. He believed he could civilize Victor. Itard's diary of his work with Victor makes this one of the most documented cases of wild children throughout history. In fact, the diary served as the basis for Truffaut's movie called The Wild Child. In Los Angeles, Truffaut's movie premiered at the Los Feliz Theater in Hollywood. One of the strangest chapters of this story is the timing of the premiere. For Truffaut's movie about history's most famous wild child opened exactly 1 week after Genie was discovered. In true Hollywood fashion, the Genie team took advantage of this coincidence. They arranged their own private screening. In charge of this event was Hospital Chief of Psychiatry Howard Hansen.
Well, that afternoon at 4:30, we left Children's Hospital and we paraded up the street. We had an entourage up the street to the Los Feliz Theater. It was awe-inspiring to us because here was the first case that had been documented in any scientific way. And here we were having an opportunity to see a film portrayal of that.
Here was history's stamp of approval for daring to rehabilitate a wild child. Itard inspired everyone at the screening.
Afterwards, everybody was shocked and stunned. They just sat in silence for a bit because the film was so powerful in itself. And then the analogy with Genie began to hit. It was like here history was repeating itself. And everybody there thought, here is an opportunity to learn something.
The screening was part of a special conference for which the Genie team invited consultants from all over the country. A government agency, the National Institute of Mental Health, had agreed to fund a scientific project on Genie. Now it was time to focus the direction of research. It soon became clear, though, that participants were unlikely to agree on one course of action.
Oh, we were off in a million directions. I mean, each expert, each person in their own discipline thought, oh, wow, I can do this, I can do this, I can do that. We were flooded with our own associations and with the pursuits that each of us might have thought, wow, look what we can do, look what we might learn from this, a girl who has appeared out of nowhere.
To bring all the proposed plans for Genie into focus, there was another player on the team, David Rigler, a psychologist at Children's Hospital. Rigler, too, was hooked on Genie's case.
I think everybody who came in contact with her was attracted to her. She had a quality of somehow connecting with people, which developed more and more, but was present really from the start. She had a way of reaching out without saying anything, but just somehow by the kind of look in her eyes, and people wanted to do things for her.
Rigler decided how to focus the research around the time of Jeannie's first birthday at Children's Hospital. Jeannie was now 14 years old. The timing was fitting because Rigler wanted to know, could the clock be turned back for Jeannie? In particular, could a teenager still learn to talk? This had already been the subject of much debate by the time Jeannie was discovered. It all began with Noam Chomsky, a young linguist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Chomsky declared that we acquire language not just because we are taught it, but because we are born with the principles of language. They're in our genes. We have language, Chomsky said, because of nature, not just nurture. Then along came a neuropsychologist to add his own twist to the theory. Eric Lindenberg agreed we're born with the principles of language, but claimed there is a deadline for applying them. If a first language isn't acquired by puberty, he said, it may be too late. Chomsky and Lindenberg rocked the field. They were hot. Linguistics was in. It was a perfect time to test the new ideas, recalls linguist Alyssa Newport.
What Lindenberg proposed is what's called the critical period hypothesis. And what he suggested is that there's a particular period in the life of humans when they're ripe for learning languages. What this hypothesis was looking for was some more direct evidence. But of course, you don't do these experiments. One never wishes to deprive somebody of language during the critical period to see what happens. It happened that at that time, when that would have been the right thing for Lindenberg's hypothesis, Genie was discovered.
This is why Susan Curtis joined the Genie team. She was a graduate student in linguistics. She would put the critical period hypothesis to its first real test. This is one of the first videotapes of Curtis's work with Genie.
A sharp square.
She wanted, it seemed to me, almost desperately to recode her world with verbal labels. And sometimes we would just stand at a window and she would take my hand and point out the window at a panorama before us, and I wouldn't really know exactly what it was she wanted to know the word for, but she would persist until she at least got a new word.
While Curtis tracked Jeannie's speech, James Kent continued work on her emotional development. Kent was concerned that with the growing number of people involved in her case, Jeannie wouldn't be able to form single, dependable relationships. So he set out to be her surrogate parent.
I wanted to be part of her sort of ordinary life, so I would frequently be there in the morning when she had breakfast, and be there in the evening when she went to bed, read her a story, kiss her goodnight, turn off the lights, go, and then do things during the day. When she had sort of important things that she had to go through, like physical exams or things like that, I would come along with her as though she were my child. She was very special to me. Mm-hmm.
Did you feel you loved her?
Well, doctors aren't supposed to love their patients. But if you could find a word that meant the same thing. Yes. Yeah, I was very attached to her. First time she saw a helium balloon, she couldn't believe them. The fact that you could let them go up and pull them back down again. She had, you know, this kind of laugh that some people have, and it's just a full-out chuckle. It's so contagious, everybody around them starts to laugh. Well, they made her laugh like that.
One of my memories was that we would go to a place, say Woolworth's, where there would be a stand of spools of thread, and spools where each color thread would incrementally change from the spools next to it. And she wanted a word for every different hue. And I didn't know. I mean, I had a box of 64 Crayola crayons as a child, and I remembered, you know, burnt sienna and all these colors that I tried to extract from my memory. But I don't, English doesn't have words for all of these different hues. And she was very frustrated when I would say, very dark blue, and very, very dark blue.
For Jeannie, every new object, every field trip was a visit to a magic kingdom. The previous fall, the world had discovered Jeannie. Now, Jeannie could discover the world.
That she passed a father and a little boy who were coming out of a shop, and the little boy was carrying a toy fire engine, and they just passed, and then they turned around and came back, and the boy, without a word, handed the fire engine to Jeannie. She never asked for it. She never said a word. She did this kind of thing somehow to people.
Could I imagine what that was like? Could I see things through her eyes? I don't believe so. I don't believe I really could. Sometimes I could understand and guess pretty well what she was going to do, but that was familiarity and not an ability, I think, to empathize with, understand the way she saw the world.
The summer after her discovery was a time of firsts for Jeannie.
Water? And if there's a glass of water, you can.
The most significant happened here, in the home of Jean Butler, her teacher at Children's Hospital.
Do you want to get some water and take it to the table?
Jeannie moved in.
You can get water, get a glass of water.
It was a new step for Jeannie, her first trial run in a foster home.
Is that what you want? This is July 11th, Mrs. Butler's house. This is lunchtime. She just took the milk and the chocolate milk into the bedroom.
Here, Butler videotapes Jeannie's passion for hoarding things, especially containers of liquid. Although there is no obvious explanation, this has been reported in other cases of children raised in isolation. Jeannie began living here after Butler said she had exposed Jeannie to German measles. It began as a temporary quarantine. Butler wanted to make it permanent. Butler, shown here with Jeannie and James Kent, wanted to be Jeannie's official foster parent. And she wanted to see changes in the handling of Jeannie's case. Butler thought frequent visits by team members Kent and Susan Curtis were exhausting Jeannie.
That was the summer when we were then both disallowed into Jean Butler's house. So, you know, we didn't have such a fun summer. It was a summer that included weeks of concern and anxiety and, you know, anger and all kinds of things because he and I were kicked out of Jean's house.
Why?
Because she was crazy and she didn't want the other attachments. I mean, She used to walk around saying, I am going to be the next Abby Sullivan. This girl is going to make me famous. And we used to sort of joke about it because she was so overt about it. And we thought, well, God, why doesn't, you know, even if she has the desire, why isn't she so willing to tell the rest of us? But she certainly found a way to concoct, you know, she concocted this story. The whole thing is untrue. She didn't have German measles. She had a rash.
The bickering continued for more than a month, according to journals left behind by Jean Butler, who died in 1988. Butler wrote she feared Jeannie was being experimented with too much.
Are you going to do that again?
Whether this was Butler's true motivation in keeping away other team members cannot be known. But it raised again the issue of how Jeannie should be treated. Could she be a scientific subject and still be a patient? On the morning of August 13th, social workers arrived at Butler's house with a decision on her application to be Jeannie's foster parent. Partly on advice from Children's Hospital, it was rejected.
We were not satisfied with the quality of the care that Jeannie had at Jean Butler's. So that had to be interrupted. And again, it was up to management, i.e. us, to interrupt that.
Jeannie returned to Children's Hospital for only a couple of hours. A new foster parent came to take her home. It was David Rigler. Rigler decided to take charge of the case. He decided to take over Kent's role as therapist and also be Jeannie's foster parent and the principal investigator.
Ordinarily, mental health people are not involved in these kinds of multiple roles, but I have to stress how desperate we were to find a place that was appropriate. And I remember making the commitment in my mind for a 3-month period, which obviously got extended much longer.
Because how long was she?
She was with us approximately 4 years.
Jeannie's new home was in a neighborhood near Children's Hospital. She lived here with David Rigler, his wife Marilyn, and the Rigler children.
We really didn't know what to expect, except that we knew that Jeannie needed a great deal of help. And on the other hand, it was very exciting to feel that perhaps we could help her and perhaps she could be rehabilitated.
Marilyn, a graduate student in human development, was Jeannie's new teacher. She soon found herself giving Jeannie unconventional lessons. Jeannie would erupt in silent storms of rage, tugging and tearing her own body. To turn Jeannie's self-destructive anger outward, Marilyn taught her how to have a fit, how to slam doors and stamp her feet. Eventually, Marilyn encouraged Jeannie to turn her pain and anger into words.
And there came a time when she could say, rough time. And sometimes she could tell you the degree of how upset she was by waving one finger, which meant she was very upset, or kind of waving her hand, which meant she was upset, but it wasn't going to be a big deal.
I jump. Yeah, you slipsy, you jump. Good. Can you jump some more?
One of Marilyn's first tasks was to awaken in Jeannie a sense of her connection to the physical world.
March. Tell me what I'm doing.
Like her historic counterpart, Victor, Jeannie seemed disconnected from certain bodily sensations.
I would allow her to run her own bath water or her own shower water. And when I would touch it, I would realize that it was icy cold. And I would say, oh, this is so cold. You're going to freeze. And it was as though it didn't make any difference.
In their new role as Jeannie's foster parents, the Riddlers were suddenly responsible for a child who needed full-time supervision. They also took responsibility for Jeannie's therapy, attempts to help her grapple with the horror of her childhood. In this primitive role-playing exercise, Marilyn pretends to be Jeannie's mother.
Hurry up, because there isn't any time. Father's going to be angry.
Marilyn tries to elicit memories of Jeannie's past.
I wonder what you're thinking. You want to see your father? Father is not living. You remember what it was like when you lived at home? What were you sitting on when you ate the cereal?
Into pot.
In the potty chair.
Potty.
Where did you stay when you lived at home? Where did you live? Where did you sleep? You slept in a potty chair?
While this videotape shows how distressed Jeannie was by her childhood, it also reveals a developmental breakthrough. Jeannie was using language to describe past events. Jeannie was talking about things that happened before words were a part of her world. For a child who barely spoke just a short time ago, Jeannie was doing remarkably well with language. Susan Curtis continued to track her progress. Jeannie could read simple words. Her vocabulary was growing. Here she is about to say, I like log.
I like log.
Let me see. The log?
I like log.
You found a picture of a log. I didn't even know you knew what a log was. Where do you see a log?
I was struck with how different the words that she knew were from the vocabulary words that young children would know when they're acquiring a first language. She had words for emotions, angry, sad, excited, happy. She had words, color words, shape words, square, rectangle.
I like circle.
You like circle.
Jeannie seemed to be pulling off a linguistics coup. She had passed the critical age of puberty, but she seemed to be learning a first language. Curtis began doubting the notion that there was a deadline for doing so.
My early ideas were that the sky might be the limit. I couldn't help thinking that she might, in fact, just be able to show that people really were wrong.
Jeannie was at last settled into her new life. She even went to a nursery school. Hopes grew that, unlike other cases of children isolated from society, Jeannie's could have a happy ending. At the Paris Institute for the Deaf, Jeannie's historic counterpart also seemed to flourish when reunited with civilization. As shown in Truffaut's movie, Victor responded successfully to methods used to teach the deaf.
Yeah.
Victor's teacher created his own methods as well. Itar used cut-out letters for lessons that are still used in kindergartens all over the world. He had a knack for gradually increasing the complexity of Victor's tasks.
Attention, Victor. Libre, ciseaux, cadre.
Ta is teaching Victor to read simple phrases like to throw a key. So he writes throw key in French and then flings a key, then expects Victor to do the same. Victor's doing well. He's reading the sentences, performing the actions, but Itar doesn't trust it. It could be by sheer memory. He's seen Itar do it. So he decides to scramble the nouns and verbs and get some weird combinations like to tear a stone, to cut a cup, to eat a broom. Presents tear a stone to Victor, and he shows some ingenuity. He goes off, he gets a hammer, and he smashes the stone. Cut a cup, picks up the cup and hurls it on the floor, and it shatters. Eat a broom. This time he changes the noun, goes off and gets a piece of bread and devours it. This was Itar, constantly analyzing, upping the ante, pushing the kid towards civilization, toward the skills that we have. And Victor generally rising to the challenge, each time taking the small step. This was the kind of struggle they engaged in together for 6 years.
Indeed, for a while, teacher and pupil were joined in a shared mission of awakening.
Yeah.
And this is as far as film director Truffaut takes his version of the story.
Many people have asked me, well, what do you think of the Truffaut film, The Wild Child, L'Enfant Sauvage? And what I think of it was that it was a pretty solid job of following Itard's reports.
Emmenez-le surposer.
But I do have one exception, and that is at the end of the film, the child climbs the stairs when the idea is that he's walking off into a future of endless possibilities in which he may even write his autobiography. And that's simply false.
In reality, the history books show that Victor's progress slowed down. Itard reported, while Victor knew how to read simple words, he never really learned how to talk. Itard recommended that the forbidden experiment be stopped.
You know, well, we attributed to Itard this motive of wanting to use Victor to build his own career, and I think that was true. When the point came that he was no longer serving Victor, nor serving science, he was no longer serving his career, he abandoned him, he let him go. Itard gave up. He asked Madame Guérin, the housekeeper, to take the boy in down the street from the deaf school. And there they lived a rather gray, sad, forlorn existence, the two of them. So the story is not as romantic as Truffaut would have us believe.
Victor lived his last days at this very spot in Paris. He died in his 40s in 1828. Victor's story did not end well. In Los Angeles, more than a century later, Jeannie's caregivers were working to ensure that their pupil fared better.
When will you see your mama in the house? When?
When Jeannie used gestures a lot to communicate, the Wrigglers arranged for her to learn sign language.
I will see mama Saturday! Right!
Critics fault the teacher in Victor's case for emphasizing spoken speech. The Wrigglers tried to avoid this mistake.
When we're all finished.
The weeks turned into months, the months into years, and David Wriggler, the man who would be scientist, therapist, and foster parent to Jeannie, seemed to find a way to juggle all those roles. In reality, the juggling act had started to fall apart.
This is the paper that's unfolded.
For years, Wrigler had trouble managing the research part of the case. Curtis's language studies proceeded, but Wrigler had been getting government money to do more. Indeed, he gathered hundreds of videos, he supervised countless tests, but he never clearly defined his own research.
Show me the shoe that's untied. Untied.
To add to the murkiness of the study was an unresolved question which would make it difficult to draw firm scientific conclusions. Was Jeannie brain damaged from birth? Team members disagreed.
My impression was clearly that Jeannie was mentally retarded from birth based on, for example, my sleep study, which showed these extreme spindles, which are fairly characteristic of severe mental retardation.
Jeannie, although functionally retarded because she had hardly lived and experienced the world around her, was not mentally deficient in any sense in which we typically think of as mentally deficient. For example, on psychological tests that measure mental age, every year after she had been found, her mental age increased 1 year. This is just not something that happens in a person with a child or an adult who's mentally retarded.
The government agency that was funding the research project grew uneasy with the scientific ambiguities of Jeannie's case.
What kind of box is this?
The National Institute of Mental Health was looking for payback for the years of money it poured into the study, and it wasn't finding any. After repeated warnings in the fall of 74, NIMH stopped funding the Jeannie project, citing a failure to collect data in a scientifically meaningful way.
Nobody knew exactly how to deal with this. We were doing our best. We got the best kind of counsel, the best kind of advice. We had to sort that out and take that as it came. But we did the very best we knew how, and we believed that nobody knew any better.
In the year following the loss of their research grant, the Wrigglers decided to end their foster care of Jeannie. Their decision caused concern among their colleagues.
It's not that it came as a surprise to us or shouldn't have. We had a lot of consultants and a lot of people coming in, and one of the questions we were asked often by more than one person is, what's going to happen here when the hospital goes away, when, you know, if the research grant goes away, if all of the sort of interest in how this youngster is developing, when the researchers fold their tents and go away, who's going to stay behind with Jeannie?
This was something that I was certainly concerned about, the fact that should we not take Jeannie because we did not plan to have her forever. And it was something that we talked about very actively. And we finally decided that if we could give her a good home with much love and rehabilitation within that home, nurturing, caretaking, and good things, that would give her the ability to cope at some later time so that she would have a good foundation and a stable home. And that was our reasoning.
What is on the red box?
For linguist Susan Curtis, it was time to sum up her years of work with Jeannie. A clear picture was emerging in her data. But for Jeannie, that picture was not promising. Here, when asked to make a question, Jeannie comes up with, what red blue is in?
What red blue is in? Does that make sense? Is that a silly question?
Jeannie didn't seem to be able to put words together in a normal grammatical way. This seemed to support the idea of a critical period for acquiring language.
In Jeannie's case, the vocabulary was what she was good at. Conveying messages is what she was good at. But if you look at a sentence that she would utter, it wouldn't be grammatical. So she might say things like, spot chew glove, applesauce by store, where the message was clear. You know, the dog named Spot chewed the glove, or we need applesauce, we need to buy applesauce at the store. But in both of these cases, you can see they're not sentences of English. We wouldn't say applesauce by store. We would say we need to buy applesauce at the store, or applesauce is what we want from the store, or something that is an actual sentence of English.
Much of the language research on Jeannie was completed by 1975, a pivotal year for her. That summer, she returned here to her childhood home to live with her mother. Jeannie's mother had been acquitted of child abuse charges. She wanted to resume care of her daughter. But she soon found it too difficult. Thus began another sad chapter in Jeannie's life, a series of placements in foster homes.
Jeannie was subjected to abuse, to punishment, to harassment, to the extreme in some of these homes. Then she would be moved again to another home, and another home. And meanwhile, we knew nothing about it until the bombshell hit. The bombshell. A lawsuit against Hansen, Wrigler, Kent, Curtis, and Children's Hospital of Los Angeles.
Like Victor's, Jeannie's case had not ended well. And now, there was a modern American twist to her story, a lawsuit.
Good.
The lawsuit, filed by Jeannie's mother, charged the Jeannie team with excessive and outrageous testing.
We're gonna be finished soon. As soon as you put all those cards in boxes, we're gonna be all finished.
The lawsuit claimed the researchers gave testing priority over Jeannie's welfare, pushing her beyond the limits of her endurance.
Look carefully. It's dark, yes. Come on. Which box does that belong in? No.
The lawyers suing Children's Hospital were Louise Monaco and Samuel Paz.
They should have had clues that they were going at things wrongly because they were getting visits from NIMH, the National Institute of Mental Health, telling them, well, gee, yeah, you got all these videos, but they're not indexed, they're not cataloged, they're all thrown in a drawer. You're doing tests that have no scientific purpose. You're doing tests that you made up.
And they were doing tests repetitively, which lose their validity with the repetitiveness.
Yeah, I mean, there's certain tests, if you administer them within a year, you can't tell whether you're measuring anything or not. You're just measuring how familiar the subject is with the test.
Okay, I'll try it again. Here, you do it. Put them in the box. I want you to work fast. Come on, let's work fast.
It was our job to measure her progress, to determine what changes were taking place. Indeed, if we had not done as much as we did, we would have really not fulfilled the purposes of our grant. But in addition to that, the testing that she underwent was by and large fun experiences for her.
Depositions were taken. Experts were summoned. And while the suit was eventually settled, it raised an important question.
Well, the decision was made.
Did the team go as far as it could go in treating Jeannie, or did the research get in the way?
We did everything we could not to exploit the case in a way that would impinge on her privacy or impact on her psychologically or emotionally. And that wasn't difficult because of the feelings we had for her.
I don't think they started out with the notion of let's exploit her for all the money we can get. I think maybe everybody started out with the notion, one, they wanted to help her, but two, this was like the biggest thing that had hit town in quite a number of years. It was right on the heels of Truffaut's movie, The Wild Child, hence the name that was given to her. I mean, when they had seminars at Children's Hospital, they showed the movie as part of the seminar. And so, I mean, this was like a worldwide attraction, so I think it was really easy to get sidetracked.
Despite all she'd been through, Jeannie's troubles were not over. In her first foster home, Jeannie was severely punished for vomiting. The experience was so traumatizing, Jeannie ended up back in Children's Hospital, where the Wrigglers offered assistance.
You couldn't help it. So now you're keeping your mouth closed so you won't vomit.
Jeannie was afraid to open her mouth. She regressed to the only way she knew how to be under siege, completely silent. This would be one of the last times the Wrigglers videotaped Jeannie. Jeannie now lives in an adult care foster home in Southern California. It's at least the sixth home she has lived in since the research project ended.
What do we take away from this really sad story? Look, there's an ethical dilemma in this kind of research. If you want to do rigorous science, then Jeannie's interests are going to come second some of the time. If you only care about helping Jeannie, then you wouldn't do a lot of this scientific research. So what are you going to do? To make matters worse, the two roles, scientist and therapist, were combined in one person in her case. So I think future generations are going to study Jeannie's case, as we've been studying Victor's, not only for what it can teach us about human development, but also for what it can teach us about the rewards and the risks of conducting the forbidden experiment.
production of WGBH Boston.